Harbour, hosh geldiniz. Hello and welcome to another edition of our podcast, Talking Around North Cyprus, where we chat about anything and everything and anybody that is connected to the TRNC. Once again, we have a bit of a military flavour to this episode, following on from Daz Barton last time round. You can look that up. It was called The Green Line One. We've had a long chat with a former commissioned officer who became the first continuity liaison officer to the Turkish forces for the United Nations. Well, I can tell you it's a fantastic story. We're going to be hearing shortly from Sam Lewis Blanc. That's coming up in a moment. After we've said hi, of course, to my co-host and resident of North Cyprus, Rog Jabara. And Rog, so often we talk about the fantastic weather you've been experienced, but I understand this week's been a bit of a shock for you. Is that right?
It was a shock in the severity of the amount of rain on one day last Tuesday. And it was forecast for there to be rain for the first time for quite a while. So everybody, you know, the day started like it normally does, nice sunshine, yeah, the clouds are coming over. It started raining and basically it never stopped for the rest of the day. Well, at least until it got dark. Torrential rain in some areas. And of course, Tuesday was the eve of Eid and it led, in the end, this rain to landslides, floods and evacuations. You know, people in Gurney had to get out of a block of flats, overfears it with collapse. Even where we live, and this was a very common story, the road outside our villa is going down effectively to the beach. And the torrent of water, after about an hour of rain, the road had ceased to exist. And it was just a very, very fast moving river. And of course, bringing all the rubbish that water running downhill brings with it. So the next day, that just everybody, every owner was out on the street clearing up, you know, rubbish. Our pool, like most people's pool, flooded underneath, the electrics went. And fairness, in the Lapta Alsancak, Chamblabel area and Karşıyaka, there was only really one power cut and it didn't last particularly long. So that was really good going, we think, from the electric company when there was absolute carnage all about. I can't tell you how many millimetres fell in that one day, but I can tell you that the meteorology department revealed that Alsancak recorded the highest rainfall, 137 kilos per square metre.
Wow.
Whatever that means. Yeah, lots and lots of rain, basically. So, yeah. But of course, now it's all back to normal, and the cleanup's almost finished, and you would barely know anything had happened untoward, really.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm glad everybody is safe. That's the main thing, because that's the worry, isn't it? When things like that happen, freak things like that happen. As you say, you know, people evacuated from blocks of flats. That's when, sadly, things happen. But I'm glad to hear that everybody was well. Also, I'm reading about more tragedy on the roads where you are. It never seems to end, does it, Rod? Nothing ever seems to be done to make the roads sort of safer. Well, it's not the roads so much. It's the drivers, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, a lot of people might think, you know, it's the drivers in the old bashed up Renault 9s that have never been taught to do. A lot of these accidents are people driving very powerful, fast cars and running out of control. And many of them now are well over the legal limit with alcohol or other drugs. And there's a real worry now. So what the government is eventually doing, they're increasing the penalties for what they call killer drivers. They don't mince their words here. If you cause death by driving over the limit, 10 years inside, 10 years, and up to 75 times the gross monthly minimum wage in fines. So you multiply almost 30,000 teller by, you know, almost 100, that's 3 million teller. Well, you're going on for 3 million teller, and we'll have to wait and see if that provides an incentive for people not to get drunk and get in their fast cars and go and kill somebody.
Yeah. And as you say, it's drugs as well. There's always a big campaign here in the UK that drugs are as much to blame as drink. I mean, you can spot drink pretty quickly, but drugs are more difficult to spot, and recreational drugs are.
And also, Sarah, one of the big things on this subject, under these proposed changes, drunk drivers are no longer going to be issued with fixed penalties. You know, there you go, be a good boy, don't do it again. They'll be referred directly to the courts for judges to decide their fate.
Yeah.
So, you know, you literally, you have been warned.
Yeah, and, absolutely. And rightly so. I mean, you've killed somebody, you know, I mean, and you knowingly did it because you're drunk and you're behind the wheel of a car. If you're drunk, you don't get in a car. And so, you know, you knowingly got in a car and
I'm talking there about maximum penalties, but if you exceed the drink drive limit of 50 milligrams per 100 of blood, you still, that's at the lowest level of being over the limit, you can still go to prison for a year under this new legislation and have a really hefty fine and a driving ban for up to 3 months.
Yeah.
So it's not just the lunatics that are completely drunk and drive. Yeah. Those that are over the limit.
Yeah,
and how many glasses of beer or wine does it need to be over the limit? One, two, if you're lucky, then, as I say, you have been, we all have been warned.
Yes, just not worth it, is it? Okay, right. Let's get on to some cheerier stuff. let's get to our special guest this week. And Rog, we're going to have to change our narrative from now onwards. We're always said we were the only podcast that deals with North Cyprus, but that's not so anymore.
It's not. There is a brand new, it started this year, I believe, a podcast called Cyprus Untold, and it takes you inside the buffer zone to discover why the Cyprus problem is still enduring to this very day and why the UN has failed to unite the island or indeed the Cypriot communities. And you, Sarah, you found this out and you found the chap behind it.
Yes, I happened to see Divided Island. We've spoken to Jay Seziguzel previously, and I happened to see that he was having another screening of his Divided Island. Sadly, I couldn't go. It was the day I got back from Morocco. I really wanted to see the film, but I saw that this gentleman had seen the film and was really excited about it. And I thought, oh, who's this gentleman? Who's this Samuel J. Lewis Blanc? And oh, hang on a minute, he's got another podcast about North Cyprus, but it's different to ours in different ways. And anyway, I reached out to him, and Sam was a commissioned officer in the British Army between 2013 and 2022. He served in the Royal Regiment of Artillery and deployed overseas to 9 separate countries across 4 different continents, including an operational tour of Afghanistan and a role supporting RAF counter-Daesh operations in Iraq and Syria. And as I mentioned in the introduction, his career-defining position, however, was the inaugural continuity liaison officer to Turkish forces for the United Nations during the period 2019 and 2021. And it was during this time he lived with his family at the British retained site in the United Nations protected area, formerly known as Jubilee Camp, which is RAF Nicosia. And that's sort of where we started with the interview, because I said to him, well, you know, what's your connection with North Cyprus?
In 2019, I deployed from the British Army to the United Nations in Cyprus as the first ever Turkish Forces liaison officer in Sector 2. So I was a continuity liaison officer. What does that mean? Effectively, the UN, they have contributing troops to UNFACYP and to all their missions around the world. Because, of course, the UN is not in itself, it's a political body, you know, so it relies on its members to supply troops to missions around the world. UNFACYP is no different. And you have 3 main sectors of the buffer zone in Cyprus, Sector 1, Sector 2 and Sector 4. Where's Sector 3 gone? Basically, they've merged and changed over time. There used to be 5, possibly even more if you go right back. In Sector 2, you've got the British who contribute the troops to Sector 2 since 95, 96 when they took over from the Canadians. Now, in UNFACYP, most of the force contributing nations will contribute their troops for a year, up to a year at a time. And the main body of troops are Slovakians, Argentinians and the British, although the headquarters element based at the old airport is every nation imaginable is there, but majority Slovakian, Argentinian, British, in order to manage the main body of troops. So the British, being the British, don't like to do the same as everyone else. So they, instead of doing 1 year at a time, they do 6 months at a time. And again, there's lots of nuances to this. The British actually pay for that rotation because the UN will pay, for example, for the Argentinians to come in once a year, which you can imagine is very expensive to move all the way from Argentina, all these hundreds of troops, and feed them and house them and all this good stuff. But the British have a very unique position on the island, of course, because we have RAF Akatiri. So it's actually quite cheap for the British to move troops in and out. And of course, they do regularly with other stuff that's going on the island. Every 6 months, the British rotate their troops in Sector 2 in Nicosia. Now, for many, many years, there was no one who bridged the gap between the two. So what you ended up with, and this is just one example, and it's a bit of a crude example, but, and I'm going to use the Turkish forces as an example, but they absolutely do this on the Greek side of the line as well, is that they'll push the boundaries. They'll maybe move a barrel a couple of meters. They'll maybe raise some sandbags. They'll cause some issues somewhere that are the disputed area in which they see as theirs to control. And the UN will say, no, that's UN buffer zone. However, the UN doesn't really have much power. And also, it hasn't really been given the mandate. It doesn't walk around with weapons anymore. It has no ability to pick up those barrels and put them back where the UN says they were in 1974. So what happens is the UN, they have a bit of a get together, an argument, maybe over a Turkish coffee. They agree to disagree. The UN will say, well, we've recorded this as a violation. The Turkish will say, yeah, thank you very much. And then they'll keep the relationship nice and cordial because that's the whole point. This is peacekeeping. And so we move to the next 6 months and the barrel moves again. And some of that knowledge over time is lost. And it's not recorded very well. There's lots of local agreements that have gone on over time as well. And some of this is in the UN archives. And effectively, it was my job was created in order to come in and bridge those 6 month tours and maintain the knowledge and be that friendly liaison to the Turkish forces in order to understand what was going on longer term. And so I was posted for 2 years. So effectively, I bridged four different tours. It ended up being five in the end, just because of the way the dates worked. And so, yeah, I was the first ever person to do this in Sector 2. There was previously a continuity warrant officer, and I believe you've interviewed one of the first, Daz, previously. Slightly different, and I don't want to go into the internal politics, but he was slightly different, or his role was different. Mine is much more liaison facing, and there was also an equivalent for the Greek Cypriot forces, the National Guard, and we also had another one who was civilian affairs. So much of the buffer zone is agricultural land, as you know, or there's areas of land that is falling apart, buildings that are falling down, it's dangerous, there's growth of flora, fauna everywhere, trees growing up everywhere, and that needs cutting down and pulling out. Who's going to do that? The UN doesn't have the capacity to do that all the time. And of course, this is one of the things I identified really quickly, is that the UN is quite biased in this way. They'll put out tenders for some of this work, but they'll negate the fact to let the Turkish side know, the TRNC, know some of the time. Why would they do, so they don't even get the opportunity sometimes, because of course that's giving them legitimacy. Sometimes they do, and there's lots of areas where there is joint work on that. So I hope that gives you a flavour just initially. There's so much I can talk about.
How much did you know about the Cyprus problem before taking up your role?
That's a great.
Did you have to learn it, or did you have to research it, or were you told it? How did it work?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. So I had no prior knowledge. I was completely ignorant, if I'm honest. That's probably the only way I can describe it. I'd never been to the island holidaying or anything like that. The only thing I'd done is fly through Akatiri post my tour of Afghanistan in 2017. And that is literally into Akatiri. You're put on a beach, given some food and a drink to try and wind down. And that was it. I had a young baby waiting for me at home, and so I was only interested in getting back to her and my wife. So yeah, I was completely ignorant. The role itself didn't come at the time as because it was brand new. There was no real formal training. Those 6 month tours that happen, they do have formal training. And so I managed to jump on the back of one of those training regimes, but that's a week. You sit in some lectures in a hall. You're shown some outdated documentaries, which are very one-sided or a very British-centric view, I would say as well from memory. I like to think it's got better because part of my role was to educate those 6 monthers coming in. And so me and my team, because I controlled that team of those warrant officers who were the continuity team, we started to go back and try and help educate in a better way. And prior to that, you also had maybe the odd person who'd been in Cyprus would go and deliver a lecture to troops coming out. And again, I had one of those individuals, but it was a southern facing, very Greek Cypriot viewpoint on the problem. So yeah, I had to do a lot of research myself.
So when you started to research it, I mean, you must have been interested in it. You must have started to pull some of
Yes.
the threads.
Yeah, I
And
love history.
were you surprised where it was all leading and what you were finding out?
Yeah, the research didn't match the reality is the main point. And once I started to engage with people on the island, my wife and I we were just learning all the time. We were in a very fortunate position, and I guess because of being the person who was liaising with the Turkish forces in Nicosia, I was just getting such a fast-tracked education and a and both sides. And I don't mean to be disparaging against Greek Cypriots at all. It was just that initial work and that initial research was very in your face, very kind of one-sided, and it didn't match what I was being told by Turkish Cypriots. And so, and my wife and I we're venturing into the north a lot. We were holidaying there, we were eating there, we were trying to soak up as much of the culture as possible. Because, and it felt weird because it was that idea of it, in UNFACYP, you're being told this is going on all the time. These are the violations. You know, this is how many violations the Turkish forces are committing on a weekly basis versus the Greek Cypriot, and that didn't match as well what I was seeing on the ground. It was actually both sides are doing stuff all the time, but it's reported on slightly differently at the time. Yeah, it was interesting, and so my wife and I definitely sought out more opportunities to learn, you know, going to lots of museums on both sides, speaking to people. We were just really, you know, open with people, just said, you know, look, we want to learn more, we don't know anything. And people were really friendly and honest. And the more we learned was that actually Cypriots in general, they have so much more in common than what we were being told about. And that was more and more fascinating the more I got into it. And of course, there's a British element to this as well. I can't get away from the fact that I've been educated in a certain way, be that in the UK and then in the British Army, especially. So I came probably with unconscious bias that I wasn't aware of. And so I had to put that to one side and I had to really listen. And some of it still is difficult to get my head around. I tell a story in one of my latest episodes. There's a church on UNPA, so the United Nations Protected Area, and one of the continuity warrant officers had a christening there, and he had been there for a while and he'd made friends with local Greek Cypriots who came to the christening. Fantastic. So they turned up, and one of the things that they said to the warrant officer after the christening was, "This is a lovely church, but why have you got memorials on the wall to terrorists?" And of course, he sort of was really bemused and said, "What do you mean?" And it was more memorials to British forces that have been killed by EOCA in the 50s. And of course, it was this complete different viewpoint that he had not really considered, that we were seen as the terrorists and they were the freedom fighters. And of course, that just blew his mind. And of course, these kind of stories, you sort of come to understand different viewpoints a lot more. And you know, if you walk around South Nicosia today, there's loads of busts, isn't there? And memorials to EOCA, what the British would call terrorists in the 1950s. And that was really odd to walk around and see that and to learn about the education system and what it teaches. And that's also complete anathema to what the British forces, to what the SBAs, so the sovereign base areas, experiences. Because that, again, is completely different. We were speaking to friends that were in the SBAs or people that maybe wanted to come up and travel to the north, and they're being fed all sorts of rubbish about the north, and not people don't want you to go there because they don't want you to spend your money there. And that's a really interesting dynamic. But we were in this fortunate position where we lived in the buffer zone. So we lived at UMPA in the British retained site. And so we really felt that we had this balance between the two. We could enter both sides freely. And we did. We wanted to experience both sides, and I miss it so much.
Oh, do you? Yeah,
I
that's
really do.
interesting.
I want to know, Sam, and I know you've been
Ooh.
asked this on your very own podcast, which we'll talk
Yes.
about later. But from what you've just said, do you actually have any sympathy out of balance between the Greek side and the Turkish side, or are you completely down the middle, which I
That's a
suppose
really,
you should
really
be,
good.
but I want to dig inside you.
Oh,
How do you feel inside?
that's a really, really good point. So I cannot get away from the fact that international law is such that it is an occupation, it is a non-recognized state, it was an invasion. I can't get away from kind of that, and maybe that is my background and my teaching, that it's hard to get away from that fact. However, my sympathy absolutely lies with young Turkish Cypriots who come into the world and effectively their education doesn't count. Their passport isn't recognized. Where do they go for funding to start businesses? They're trapped. And that to me is where my biggest sympathy lies, is that the young Turkish Cypriot who I met numerous occasions. So in meetings I would go to with Turkish forces commanders, they're in, because I don't speak Turkish, by the way, before that, if that comes up. We had interpreters who were young Turkish Cypriots or young mainland Turk conscripts, and most of them had been educated in the UK. And they were much more liberally minded than a lot of the commanders, to say the least. And so we'd have a lot of open conversations, and it was quite amusing because you'd walk into a meeting and the Turkish commander, very staunch, Merhaba, and you sort of start engaging in that a bit of Turkish initially, and then you turn to the interpreter who would say, "You're right, mate." Oh, where are you from?
From
And
East
of course they.
London.
Yeah, and they, yeah, exactly. Oh, I'm from North London, mate. And I went to Manchester University for 4 years before coming to do my conscription, and that was amazing. But it was the reality was that they had to go somewhere else a lot of the time to get education that was recognised. I remember a guy showing me, well, I have my, and he said, "Oh, I can't show my commander this, but I have a Republic of Cyprus passport in order to travel around the EU freely." So it's these realities that I found fascinating as well. And what about British expats now in the north as well? So yeah, it's a really tricky one. I'm trying to, in my storytelling, I'm trying to remain as middle ground as possible, because I don't feel both sides stories are told side by side often. And when they are told, because it's one-sided, you then don't hear the opposite side. So I'm trying to do that, but my sympathy lies with young Turkish Cypriots because of the position that they're in.
So going forward, with everybody literally having a different perspective on living in Cyprus, where do you see the future? I mean, how does this unravel, or how do you bring everybody together? I mean, where are we going? How do we fix this Cyprus problem?
Yeah, that's so something I probably missed off from the previous question, but it links to this really nicely, is and I think you'll both be able to tell me the reality more recently, but the sense that we were getting back in 21 is that Erdogan's control of Northern Cyprus is becoming such that it's making it much more unlikely that there will be unification of any kind. And that adds to the plight of young Turkish Cypriots, who, in my analysis, everyone will feel differently, and I'm speaking from my own opinion, that Turkish Cypriots are not the same as mainland Turks. I got that from many, many perspectives on the island, forces-wise and people, culture, religion, everything about it. There was definitely a distinction in my mind. And if we can move away from Erdogan's version of Northern Cyprus, I think we'll be in a better position. However, let's also not forget that the Greek Cypriot governments walked away from unification multiple times. I remember, so one of the ways that I learned really quickly when I joined the island was I sat with the political advisor in the UN headquarters, who is very close to the coal face of the Cyprus problem, and had been there for many, many years. And I learned lots from him, and I was always engaging with him. Whenever he did a talk, I'd be there trying to learn from him. And I remember him describing when the last time that the talks failed, he said that the Northern administration had signed the deal. It was done. The Greek Cypriot side, so the Republic of Cyprus government, they were the ones who walked away. And he said he described a scene where people were on their knees crying and clawing at the leaders to sign. They were that desperate, and it felt so, and there was so much passion and want for this. And ever since that point, it's just gone downhill. Politically, in the buffer zone, it's got much worse. Obviously, a coup attempt in 2016 in Turkey seem to change things a lot. There seems to be a trend since that point. Again, I'm only going by what I'm taught by sort of the military intelligence side of the British Army, and sort of elements of the UN, is that since that point there was a bit of a purge in Northern Cyprus, the same as there was in mainland Turkey, of liberally minded people in education, people in the military, people in politics and the civil service, and that happened in Northern Cyprus as well. So what you saw is a much harder change. And what that meant in the buffer zone is you got much more aggressive and confrontational impact. So those moving of those barrels became quite a firm move of those barrels, with barbed wire and threats of arrest. We're going to arrest UN forces if they enter this area. I can't get away from that as well. You asked, how do I remain down the middle? That's very tricky when you're physically threatened by another force. And that was quite odd, because Turkish forces are part of NATO. So one minute you might be wearing your UN beret, but the next minute you could be joint in a mission somewhere else in the world. I remember there was a one of the commanders for the mainland Turkish forces just west of Nicosia. He came in. He was this big, gruff commando style commander. I really, really, really liked him. But he'd done a lot of counterterrorism work in northern Iraq and northern Syria. Now, don't want to go into the politics of that specifically, but ultimately, some of the work he was doing was combating ISIS, who are an enemy of the UK as well. And so, on one level, you can absolutely agree on certain things, and so you draw on those things. What certain things can you agree on, and can you connect? You can make connections with people over, but the next minute you can't get away from, but you're threatening UN soldiers in the buffer zone. One of your soldiers cocked a weapon. That's very dangerous activity. We need to argue about that, and we're going to write you a very naughty letter, to tell you off for that, because that's all the UN can do.
You mentioned how much you miss the job that you had working on the Green Line, and yet it was quite a few years before you started your podcast. So what happened in the intervening years? Was that spent researching your subject so that you could do the podcast? How did it come about?
My wife and I had the idea. So back to your point, actually, about how do you research when you're going to Cyprus? What do you learn? Where, who's teaching you this stuff? From a UN perspective, there's probably like two books that people recommend. Everyone talks about Bitter Lemons, of course, Lawrence Durrell, kind of like classical, got to read it. But a lot of young people these days might struggle. So I'd probably say listen to it on Audible. Then there's a book by Brigadier Henn, who was the first commander of the British forces in Unficit when it became the buffer zone in 74. He's done quite a comprehensive book about it, but it's, I would say it's outdated, certainly not modern. And then there's the odd other book here and there. Martin Bell has done a book, who I took into the buffer zone, just a side note there. There's nothing else. And then there's all these documentaries. Of course, Johnny Harris has done a great documentary, and the recent Divided Island, which I can tell you about as well, because I saw it recently. So my wife and I were thinking, let's produce a book that bridges that gap between the old books and something new. But I was still in the military, so I hadn't left at that point. So there's some tricky bits there in terms of, I actually deployed back to Cyprus, but it was into the sovereign bases, and it was on a separate operation doing counterterrorism and certain work in other parts of the Middle East. So I was working with the RAF and the fast jets there. So there was the reality that I didn't really have the time. I had three young children, and I was leaving. And so we felt it was something I would do when I left, but we knew that we wanted to do something prior to the 50-year anniversary. We felt that was that's the thing we're trying to build to. I wrote about 10,000 words. I didn't think it was very good. It was just the start. Went to a couple of publishers. They liked the idea. They said, "We'll give you 10% royalties, but we need 80,000 words by Christmas last year." And I was like, "Oh, crikey!" At the time, I think I had a 6-month-old at my heels. I've got a 7-year-old and a 5-year-old, and it was just wasn't going to be the reality. And so we then went, "Let's do a podcast. It's more manageable. I can do it in chunks." And a lot of people were saying to me, "Actually, I think you're better at speaking this stuff than you probably are writing it, because it's very tricky to understand the buffer zone. It's much more visual, and that's probably a challenge of the podcast and why I have an Instagram page where I connect people to say, this stuff I'm talking about, you can go see it. Because by the way, I've got photos that some people have never seen." And so again, it's that kind of bridging that gap of what's unique, what's untold, what's different. Because lots of people talked about the buffer zone, but not the modern buffer zone, not all the problems that have been happening, certainly in the last 20, 30 years. And so it's trying to bring everyone up to date and help them understand why is the problem still enduring. And back to your question, Sarah, on how do we unify? And this is probably where some of this work starts, because what do you do? I was told that the reason that the Republic of Cyprus walked away from these agreements was all to do with property. It was all to do with land dispute and property dispute, nothing else. And so until you sort that out, you're probably never going to get unification, sadly. And I'd seen those issues, because we talked about right at the beginning, those barrels moving. Why is that important? It sounds really trivial, doesn't it? And it sounds daft. But if you move that barrel a couple of meters every 6 months, after so many years, it becomes a football field of land. And then that football field gets built on. And then the UN have lost that entire football field, illegal, to an illegal move, violation, whatever you want to call it. But then 50 years later, I don't know how this works illegally, but is there squatters' rights that says that's now part of the TRNC? And that's it. But there's somebody walking around the world with a deed to that land who now wants to dispute that or wants money in compensation for it.
Sorry, I heard you say in one of your podcasts about reparation, and there was a, I think he was a Greek Cypriot, and they offered him money, and
Yes.
he said, well, no, it's not, because yes, that might be the value of it now, but actually it was arable land and I could have made X amount in that,
Correct,
in
yeah.
those intervening years. So it's really nuanced, isn't it?
It's really nuanced. Do you turn the buffer zone into a bit like Varosha? Do you turn it the whole thing into some kind of tourist destination? I've heard that been floated around the UN before about the Green Line itself. So, for listeners who are not aware, the green line, especially from an internal UN perspective, what we're really talking about is Nicosia green line, because the rest of it, because the whole thing is called the buffer zone, but where it started, the green line is actually predates 74. So the green line was an area that the British marked out where the communities had become divided in Nicosia, and that's where like a lot of the real nasty fighting had been going on. That's where the green line started, and it kind of, yeah, it shifted a little bit here and there, and obviously now there's a modern version, if you like, of that known as the buffer zone. But that green line part has been used for many, many years by the UN to, we call it buffer zone tourism. So they affect any new diplomat or someone of worth who comes to the island will get taken on the green line tour, basically. And that tour is fascinating. You know, it's absolutely unbelievable. And a lot of my stories that I talk about are stuff that many Cypriots, many people around the world have never heard of, never seen. And that's where it all comes from, is that is the Nicosia green line tour. There was thought that you could turn that into a tourist tour, you know, put huge glass ceilings on either side of the buffer zone, because it's effectively a road width, most of it, around sort of snakes around through Nicosia, the old city in the center. And they'd make millions. They'd make so much money out of that, because a lot of it's falling down, it's crumbling as well. So what are you going to do with that? Oh, it's going to be hard work to unpick all of that, and the lawyers, and are the lawyers going to come in and say, yes, that barrel, we have it on UN record that that barrel and those sandbags and that barbed wire and all of that was back there, you know, 100 meters. What are you going to do about it? Here's a really good example that will come up at some point, because you all have seen this and lived, and it will be interesting to see your experiences of this. So in Ledger Street, the crossing point, there's a huge wooden structure, isn't there? In
Yes.
The buffers, yes, that got built in end of 2019. Now at the southern end of that structure, the Turkish administration have put up a sign that says "Welcome to the TRNC." So as you're coming to that area, people look at that and think, "Okay, I'm now entering the TRNC." But that's actually a disputed area, because if you were facing north from the buffer zone, there's a old Turkish Cypriot military position about 50 meters back, next to where their passport checkpoint is. Now, the UN definition, and this is not me saying this, this is just, you know, talking about what the archives say and what the agreements say for the ceasefire, is that the forwardmost built up military position that was there in 74, that is where the UN defined the ceasefire lines. So let's say there's a collection of barrels, a hut, a bunker, something like that. Then 20 meters to the left and right, there's probably another one. Draw a line between those positions. That's your ceasefire line. So it's very clear in Ledger Street, if you stand under that hut and look north, you'll see the positions to your north. That's where the ceasefire line is. And don't get me wrong, that wooden hut, again, this is the reality on the ground. Wow. I need some shade when I'm walking through there. So that hut is brilliant. But they've now taken 20, 30 meters of the buffer zone. And there was quite a nasty incident in 2020 when the UN tried to physically impose themselves by going down that hut and saying, essentially patrolling that area. And members of, well, some of them were just people in civilian clothing, pretty certain they were military, they basically punched their way and pushed the UN back to in front of that sign, claiming, no, this is all TRNC. And that's the kind of situations that have evolved. And again, in the future, does that mean that that's it? Those buildings now that align with that wooden hut, that's all now TRNC land. So, and is there value to that? Because you're talking prime real estate in the center of the capital. That's worth something to somebody.
Yeah.
And that's the problem you've got. And if you don't get over all those issues, then I don't see unification. And chatting to the guys at Too Fresh, who just created the Divided Island documentary, there's some really fascinating insights. And I sat there with a lot of Turkish Cypriots and Greek Cypriots watching that. And yeah, there's definitely a feeling amongst the Cypriot community in the UK, I got a sense of, was that unification isn't going to happen.
Yeah.
So what is it that we're going to do? Is a two-state the safer option for everybody, essentially? So yeah.
But then you've got to get over that international law, haven't you?
Absolutely. Yes.
Of
Yes.
saying that
That's the yeah.
Turkey is an invading force, in effect. That's what international law says.
Yeah, so do the UN leave and do the Turkish forces leave? The Turkish, and when we say Turkish forces, I mean mainland.
Yeah,
Because
yeah.
I've got no issue with, a state having a defense force, just
Cool.
like any other force in the world. So there'll be a Turkish Cypriot force, which there is. The only problem is that they're completely propped up by the Turkish mainland. Like a lot of the other infrastructure of the north, is it relies on funding and support and training from Turkey.
Yeah.
Sam, can I ask you your feelings if the UN were to disappear and if the mainland Turkish army were to go back home? Do you sense in the present climate, or at least the climate you experienced in 2019, 2020, 2021, do you feel it might all happen again? And aggression against Turkish Cypriots might happen because, frankly, there's nothing to stop it.
I'd like to think not. I like to believe that we've moved on, humans, as just in terms of the way the state of the world. Sorry, the generational shift. I'd like to think a lot of those people on the line, like the young Greek Cypriot who is stood on the line for 12 hours a day. A lot of them don't see the point in it. Again, it's a generation. That was my sense. It's a generational thing. The elderly generation are espousing peace, and they're the ones who talk about back in the day. We were all just Cypriots. We were all mixed, and we were went to school together, and there was no hard feeling. Where did this all come about? The young generation don't understand it, and are much more liberally minded generally around the world, I would say. So it's that middle generation, and I'm really, that's a sweeping statement, I know. But if they're the ones in power, they're the ones who are going to be commanding these young Greek Cypriots to say, go and enact this. I don't think the Greek Cypriot, those young Greek Cypriots, would do it anyway. And also, a lot of them, they're not really trained to do it. They don't actually have live weapons, a lot of them, on both sides. It's a bit daft, some of it. It's just for show. A lot of it is quite amusing. However, Gaza has shown something as well. Now, a lot of people probably don't realize this, but the timing of when Hamas attacked Israel, it was 50 years to the day since the attack in 1973. So
Right.
there is a danger that some people might want to replicate that in Cyprus, but I think it's a minority. I really think it's a minority. We definitely need to get over the educational issue in the Republic of Cyprus, because people are still being fed rubbish. Some of it is very anti-British sentiment, and I get where that comes from, but that's very much the 1950s, 40s, 30s thing, as opposed to post them. I'd like to think not. I hope not. There is a danger. But I really don't see it. Cypriot people, again, my sense is just that they're just lovely people. They're so
Yeah.
family orientated. And how many families are mixed? How many people are all they've moved on from that. I'd like to think there's still too much trauma, and they're still trying to find bodies of missing people. Yeah, I really think the likes of Cyprus Unite Now. There's so many organisations out there beyond the UN. And that are ingrained in Cyprus, both sides of the island, that would sort it out. I just can't see it.
While you were chatting there with Sam Lewis Blanc, I have to say, just some incredible insight into what goes on in that buffer zone with the United Nations, how it works. We've never, well, I've certainly never had a personal insight into anything like that. I know we spoke to Daz Barton before, and he sort of preceded Sam in a different role, but in that area. So just absolutely fascinating. So much more to come from Sam. We chatted for over an hour, actually. So we've got more of the interview to come. And so you can hear the rest of our conversation next week. And you may well adjust your thinking of the Cyprus problem. He certainly gives us food for thought, doesn't he, Rog?
Absolutely. And I was a bit jealous he'd been to see the film, The Divided Island, because we have heard such great reports. We knew it was going to be pretty good because, you know, Jay that directed it, made it, the Turkish Cypriot. And of course, his colleague, the guy he works with in his film production company, is a Greek Cypriot. You can't get more down the middle than that. So I was a bit jealous when I heard Sam had been to see it. But like you say, his, and you'll hear more about this next week as well, you know, he came with a biased point of view to Cyprus because that's what he was told, how things were. And he's found it all out for himself, doing his own research. And more importantly, the biggest thing he said, talking to the people, talking to real people, not bosses, not textbooks, real people who'll tell him how it is or how they see it. Very interesting. As you say, so much more to come next week.
Indeed, indeed. So do click on subscribe, however you're listening to this, so you'll know when the next one is out. I mean, if you're listening to this on catch up, you can go straight to it now and hear all about it. If you've got a story to tell us, you can get in touch anytime. We'd love to hear from you. Just look for us on Facebook or Twitter. Look for Talking Round North Cyprus. Our email is trnc.podcast@gmail.com. I'm Sarah Palmer.
And I'm Roger Mara. Thanks so much for listening. I can assure you we both appreciate it very much. And we look forward to talking to you again very soon.